Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, July 30th, 1998, and the fireside room this morning is Paul Rohde. Today's session number is 98-4, and it is titled, Save Us From Trial, Paul. Let's listen in.
Hey, this morning, my name is Paul Rohde. I come to Holden Village from New Ulm, Minnesota, where I work as a pastor. And I'm delighted to be in conversation with you in and around and through the Word. I said at the outset that my hope was that we would not only hear the scriptures, but that we would hear the scriptures hearing us. One thing for us to say we know the Word, and quite another to say that the Word knows us. This week we've been working on portraits of prayer. We've been listening to characters of the Bible in prayer. Today we're going to listen to St. Paul in 2 Corinthians chapter 12. Of the passages I chose for our work, this is an exception. There are chairs yet back here. Don't be embarrassed. Come on in. This is an exception in as much as it doesn't have the narrative detail, especially the way yesterday where we knew they were in a garden, it was at night, Jesus threw himself on the ground, and I think all of those story details really help our imaginations. This is going to be very sparse for character, narrative detail. I put it late in the week for this exact reason, so we could have practiced seeing with our mind's eye a person in prayer. Who is this person and what is he or she facing? And you've done very well in the discussion, so I'm hopeful that this too will go well. In some ways, this is a letter about Paul's prayer. It isn't quite as immediate or as direct. It doesn't have the direct quotation of prayer, some of the others we have read. But it is Paul describing his own prayer to his friends in Corinth. So then I will start reading chapter 12, verse 1. I must boast. Remember, Paul is writing to his friends. Okay, we're overhearing a conversation here. So I hear this sort of in the category, I just have to tell you.
Excuse me, what book of chapter 12?
I'm sorry, 2 Corinthians. Very fair question. 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 1. I must boast. I just have to tell you, Paul says. There's nothing to be gained by it, but I will go on to visions and revelations of the Lord. I know a man in Christ who 14 years ago was caught up to the third or to the third heaven, whether in the body or out of the body, I do not know. God knows. I think interpreters are in fair agreement that Paul is here talking about himself. He casts it in the third person, but it is so like his own story, as he's recorded in Galatians and it's described in Acts, that and he's going to move so fluidly into the first person so soon that even if he's not talking about himself, he's talking about a person with whom he clearly identifies. So he's had this vision of heaven, doesn't even know if he's in the body. He is a mystic in probably a narrower sense of the word than Dorothea Zola uses it. Dorothea is using that very experientially, the mysticism of all experience, but here is this really profound, ecstatic vision experience. He says it again. And I know that this man was caught up into paradise. Whether in the body or out of the body, I do not know. God knows. And he heard things that cannot be told, which no one may utter. On behalf of this man, I will boast. But on my own behalf, I will not boast, except of my weaknesses. Though if I wish to boast, I shall not be a fool. For I shall be speaking the truth. But I refrain from it so that no one may think more of me than he sees in me or hears from me. St. Paul is a theologian who is very clear about total dependence on Christ, our freedom being on that soul dependence. And having read that in other places, you can hear that rattling around beneath here. But he sets up this prayer with this ecstatic vision, boasting. I've got to tell you, but I'm not going to boast. That kind of both and. Here he goes, I shouldn't tell you, but you sort of conversation. He's had this experience that words cannot describe. He's heard voices that words cannot tell. He doesn't even know if he's in the body. But he's going to boast of something he considers even greater, something he can describe. And that's going to be the focus of our discussion this morning. Verse 7. And to keep me from being too elated by the abundance of revelations, a thorn was given me in the flesh, a messenger of Satan to harass me, to keep me from being too elated. 3 times I besought the Lord about this, that it should leave me. But he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. I will all the more gladly boast of my weaknesses, that the power of Christ may rest upon me. For the sake of Christ, then, I am content with weaknesses, insults, hardships, persecutions, and calamities. For when I am weak, then I am strong. We'll take it real slowly, okay? We're going to start with thorn. And then we're going to start with, and then we're going to move to what was said about the thorn. And then we'll talk about what was resolved. Even though this didn't have the narrative quality of the other things I wanted to work on, I couldn't resist working in this with you because I think the metaphor is so rich and the resolution here is so helpful. So no doubt one of the questions is, what is the thorn? I have good news and bad news. The bad news is I don't know what the thorn is. You can get your money back at the registrar. The good news is I'm glad I don't know. Because I think the not knowing the thorn for sure gives the metaphor a universality and an openness that allows lots of us to use it in lots of situations. I can give you some examples from some of the things I've read, okay? There are many who are convinced that the thorn in the flesh is a physical malady. When Paul concludes his letter to the Galatians, he says, see with what large letters I write when I write with my own hand. And some speculate that maybe he had an ophthalmological problem, had trouble seeing, so wrote with very large letters. That is, I mean, this is kind of how it goes. People will go to somewhere else in the Pauline letters and say, well, he writes this here, and so maybe it could be that. I mean, or it could have been some other kind of disease. I mean, to write in large letters, he may have been arthritic. A physical kind of thing. Especially because he concludes by saying, therefore I have learned to be content with insult. There are others who suggest that the thorn is other people. You may have difficulty imagining that could be true. And some will even be specific in, again, in believing that it's the Jerusalem Christians. Paul has become the apostle to the Gentiles. For first century Christians, what to do with non-Jews who came to believe in Jesus was a very significant issue. Did they need to ascribe to the dietary laws, be circumcised, all the kinds of things that had identified faithful people for millennia? Paul believed they did not. They were full sisters and brothers because they believed in Jesus through faith in Christ. But the Jerusalem Christians didn't see it that way. So Paul's ministry is based out of Antioch, and there was no shortage of tension between them. So maybe the thorn in the flesh was other people. And specifically, it's thought at times that it was the Jerusalem Christians. Some will read the passage and think that it is mental illness. And others will read things again from other parts of the Pauline literature and even believe they know which mental illness it was. There's still others who are concluding that it is his sexual orientation and they go to Romans 7 and some of the places that some of Paul's ideas about sexuality are at least limited, if not twisted, and so they'll have that conclusion. I will offer you this much for sure. I believe the thorn in the flesh is real. Or to make it clearer, that it is reality. Paul has had these visions, these ecstasies, these ideals, what it could be, should be, might be, woo, is so exciting. And then there is something, or many things, that pulls him back. He knows now he's in the body. When he's in his visions, he's not sure he's in the body, but he knows here he's in the body. We had a friend who was able to say exactly what I mean. She said, I raised several perfect children before I had my own. you hear what I'm saying? That of this, I am convinced that the thorn is real. And maybe in the only example better than non-parents knowing exactly how to raise children are, it is the idealism and the energy of new college or new seminary graduates who, you know just exactly what's going to happen in their classroom and their laboratory and their office and how it's going to be, and the sort of cooperation and harmony and wonder and peace that will reign there. And in about 6 weeks, know that the curriculum needs to be scrapped because these ideals aren't being realized. And then reality starts to take hold, and there is that intersection of the ideal and the real. Well, that's some of the speculation of others and some of my thoughts. What do you see when he says, a thorn was given me in the flesh, a messenger from Satan to harass me, to keep me from being too elated. Such a problem, to be too elated. What do you see?
Go ahead. His life before his conversion.
Okay. You want to say some more about that?
Well, it would seem to me that some of the things that happened that he was involved with would come back to torment him. Mm.
The stoning of Stephen, perhaps. Mm. The writer in Acts tells us he was present to watch Stephen martyred. It could very possibly be that thing from the past that keeps coming back to haunt. Okay, thank you. Other things that... I mean, the beauty of there not being narrative detail is it's really wide open for our imaginations. And I yearn only for our conversation to be wide open. I mean, let's listen to whatever is anyone's imagination.
Well, I think your example of the woman who raised all of her children before she had her own, it could be false. It could be something in that. And Paul, realizing that with all of the vigor that he tried to persecute the Christians, and how what a perfect Jew he was, and now he realizes that his perfection was something that got him in trouble. Mm-hmm. I just thought of that. I hadn't thought of that before.
Well, you are not the first who has thought it was perfection. Mm-hmm. There is a real critique here of perfectionism. You know, or of visions of get, you know. It's so, somebody at 745 said the thorn is the if-onlys. The if-onlys. That you get various spheres to the place you want to get them, and then there are that now if-only.
I can see the potential for pride, especially as you go on into the number 11, the 11th verse there, where he's saying that he's not a super apostle, but he's sure not any lower than anybody else, kind of thing.
Well, he has already set it up, concerned about pride, that he would not be boasting. There were folks at 745 whose imaginations took them back to Job, and they thought about Job and the persistence of suffering, of questions of haunting. We decided at 7:45 that persistence of Job is a better summary than patience of Job. You know, when I read the book of Job, I don't hear patience. I do hear persistence. Persistence in two directions. Persistence in the pain and agony and crises that will not stop, that seem not to stop, and the persistence with which Paul insists that he wants his question, or Job insists that he wants his question to go before God. So, go ahead.
Well, another thing that just occurred to me is that I would ask the question, in telling the story to his friends, I always thought it was a larger group. What does he want them to hear? I mean, he's talking about how important weakness is.
Yeah.
What does he want them to hear?
Let's hold on to that one for just a second, okay? What does Paul want them to hear? That bring me back if I forget, okay? There was another person at 7:45 who spoke eloquently about the times she believes she has something resolved. And then a couple days later it comes back again. And the way that is a thorn. Any other thoughts about that?
I just have a question. Why is it from Satan?
Mm-hmm. Why is it from Satan? Any opinions about that?
All good things come from God and all bad things come from Satan.
Well,
related to the comment about pride possibly being it, it seems, and maybe this does relate to why it's from Satan. Paul has a huge ego, and I think he knows both things, that he has a huge ego, and that it gets in the way, and that what it gets in the way of is his being a totally open vehicle to Christ's work. And that is from Satan. In that sense, one's ego is from Satan. One's self-centeredness can be a block to Christ-centeredness. I think Paul has a sense of struggle about that. He does have a huge ego. I mean, so many passages in his letters, he's talking about himself.
Well, and I appreciate you using self-centeredness in addition to the word ego, because I think the self-centeredness can take so many forms, including false humility, that or passiveness can still be very self-centered, though it's not particularly egotistical, or it's not seen so much as egotistical. When we talk about personality traits, the interesting thing people often do, I mean, what comes to mind is sort of the characteristic of yourself you really like the least, is to recognize how often it is also related to your strength. You know, that those are sort of flip sides of the same thing. People will say, oh, he's so outgoing. It's just really a delight to be with him, but he's so domineering. Or she's so well organized. And does she get things done, but she's so rigid. You know, well, you see, these things are connected. And good organization, you know, takes some firmness. But I have not forgotten your question. At the very least, don't you think the satanic reference description says something about its intensity? That this is evil, and it threatens to be his undoing. And the thing that's interesting there is it that the thorn threatens to be his undoing, or is it his preoccupation with the thorn? Is it the problem, or is it how important we think the problem is? Before we move on, just a second, we said a little about perfectionism. I love the examples from the world of stitchery, or fabrics, where Navajo women will always weave an error into their weavings, because only God is perfect. And then having used that example, people tell me that it's true of Amish quilters as well. They will put in one piece that doesn't match. A friend of ours who runs a stitchery shop says that stitchers in many cultures not only do it, but then it becomes sort of a Where's Waldo kind of thing, you know, to find that. And in some ways, I'm teasing about that. In other ways, I think there is something about human nature that kind of wants to find the flaw. To, you know, it is what makes good fiction, and that, you see, that is the flip side of this satanic reference, because the error is there, but it's laughable, and it's not hidden, and there's no preoccupation with it or harassment, and so it's a real important question to me whether the problem is the thorn. Or whether the problem that Paul insists that it is satanic. You see, I cannot live with this. And so Paul prays. Today we only have one verb for the prayer. It is the verb beseech, which is a very powerful asking. Now we've talked about asking in various descriptions through each of the prayers this week, because we didn't want prayer to be only asking. And we've acknowledged the narrowness of thinking of prayer only in terms of asking or getting. And some of why I wanted this prayer in our discussion was for the way it's asked and for the shape of what is gotten here. Really, beseech, I think, could better be translated demand. I demanded of God that this thorn be removed. I demanded. I insisted. I besought. It's among the strongest verbs in Greek for asking, this beseeching. How do you react to that? Is demanding a helpful prayer verb for you?
It's an honest prayer verb.
It's a what?
It's an honest prayer verb.
It's an honest verb.
Yeah. And I think it really does mate with jokes. Sentence too.
I think it does too.
And the messenger from Satan part, I think, comes in it. And I particularly like your expansion of the passage to suffering in general, because suffering, I think, does that, makes one say, why did I deserve this? Mm-hmm. You know, what is it that I did that makes me deserve this and puts that demand?
Other reactions to demand?
I like the fact that it was done three times. If you've ever had a child who demanded something once, usually that's enough. The answer is either no or yes, and it's done with. But Paul demanded three times.
Yeah, although I'm frankly troubled that it's only three. because especially when life can be so persistent, life is good, it just takes a long time, seems to me. Roberta, how many of you were in Roberta's session yesterday? Roberta Bondi did some things with John 11 that I think complement what we might hear from Paul. She's talking about the story that's often called the raising of Lazarus, but really heard it not so much about Lazarus, as about Jesus' friendship with Mary and Martha. The story is that Lazarus is sick, and Mary and Martha send a message to Jesus that Lazarus is sick, and Jesus doesn't come. And then Lazarus dies, and so they send another message that he has died. And so Jesus is coming to Bethany, and on the way meets Martha, who the scripture says to him, if you had been here, this would not have happened. And Roberta offers this paraphrase. Where the heck were you? Which I can hear in what Martha is saying. And Roberta then traces the friendship through the gospel and how the freedom for that kind of candor, the where were you, is a demanding kind of question, frees you for other kinds of openness. I mean, the thing And I think that can be real helpful. If the thorn is another person, the sort of demand you have to change opens the consciousness to what is the obvious rejoinder. Well, then you have to change. See? Very easy for us to know how the other should change. But if prayer is an opening, the strength of this candid language may in fact accomplish that. Any other reactions?
I think that when you said demanding, before you said that word, I was thinking plead. Mm-hmm. Pleading or begging. And demanding, I think, if Paul were indeed demanding, then it must mean that he had pretty much trust in God to be able to do that. I mean, it would be scary, I think, for me to put my foot down. You know?
Yeah.
And so there must have been some confidence in Paul that allowed him to do that. Mm-hmm. In such a strong manner.
Yeah. Confidence in Paul and certainly intensity in the experience. Mm-hmm. Don't you think? Mm-hmm. So we have beseech, demand, plead. Any other verbs you hear? How do you picture him doing it? Well, go ahead.
Well, the NRSV translation says, "I appealed to the Lord." Which is a very different feel about it to me than the word demanding.
Yes, it does. How does it feel to you?
Well, I've been kind of thinking about that. I don't know. Appeal is more just I'm going and kind of pleading, well, I guess pleading my case, or stating my case, rather than saying, God, you got to do this for me. So I don't know. A little different.
I'm glad you offered it, though. It's trial language.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there's a sense in which it's probably a little less impudent or something, but it's just as assertive. Don't you think?
Yeah, probably.
Because an appeal assumes that the judgment has come down and the judgment is wrong.
That's true. That's
you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's a good slant on it.
The appeal is the second phase of a trial. And saying, well, you may think you heard the truth. And we're back to the repetition of it.
My version says pleaded.
Pleaded.
NIV. Verse 8 says, three times I appealed to you.
Yes.
But you said the Greek verb was one of the strongest ones that was used here, and they usually translate that beseeching.
Well, the thing that happens, you see, the thing that happens with translation is that the ancient language doesn't change so much, but English changes. How many of you say beseech? All the time, yes. We should do that. We should, in the village today, we should beseech. These sort of subversive beseechers. Wouldn't that be fun? Can you imagine people at the snack bar? I beseech a chocolate chip cookie dough.
Now.
And, you know, I mean, the best example I know of that is, in fact, the stoning of Stephen, which we already had a reference to with Paul's past life. Because the old translations, which aren't that old, said Stephen was stoned. Translations. That's right. Translations. Now say they threw stones at Stephen. Because being stoned has come to mean something other than having stones thrown at you. See? So English keeps moving. And the other thing, semantics will tell us that words don't have meaning, people have meaning. So I think dialogue over these words is so important. And to hold them lightly, not to assume that because they mean one thing to us. If you've ever worked a crossword puzzle, you know that a word can mean many, many different things. But I do think our discussion around all the words has served us well to capture intensity and freedom and openness and confidence. Does it serve Paul's relationship with God well? Does it serve his faith well? How is it resolved? He says, three times I besought the Lord about this, that it should leave me. But he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. The sufficiency of grace. The thorn doesn't get less. The grace gets more. That power of accepting that God's grace is big enough, wide enough, open enough, strong enough to accept this, to live with it, even to be glad for it, be grateful for it in a way, because it has shown him the providence and mercy of God, that it can handle that. The other night in the forum, there were a number of critiques made of the church, and in terms of the way it's perceived by younger people. And in many ways, I share the critique, but I have a different response to it, because it's like the discovery that the church is imperfect is in some ways a huge disappointment. The discovery that the church is really imperfect can be a crisis of faith, but it can also be the greatest testimony that there is room for you.
Did you say that before?
No. I didn't. I just listened before. When I hear someone being really ornery in church, of course it depends what topic they're being ornery about, but I, you know, sometimes I get disgusted, and then again sometimes I think, well, good, then I guess I can be ornery here too. You know what I mean? You hear that as room for the sufficiency of grace. Go ahead, Nancy.
Well, there's a wonderful song on this on the new CD that Bread for the Journey put out. It's the Global Songs, too.
Uh-huh.
And it's, mine is the church where everybody's welcome. I know it's true because I got through the door.
Uh-huh.
And then the image of this church is a vase where there's all kinds of flowers.
Uh-huh.
And so that, for me, is just really a wonderful image.
Yeah.
I'm welcome here, and I know it because I got through the door, so everybody else must be welcome, too.
Yeah, exactly. To give a different kind of example, picture, in my own imagination, I think of my internship supervisor's wife. Her name was Dag, short for Dagmar. And she had suffered chronically and as intensely as anyone I know with rheumatoid arthritis. Her entire body was twisted with it. She had to have toes amputated because they had so turned under that she would be walking on top of them. It was tragic, and I think it defies imagination how painful it might have been. And after years, the arthritis went into remission. So she was not in pain, but she was left with a body that was severely diminished and weak, really weak. And at the same time, there was a strength in her spirit and her gratitude for being pain-free and her vigor to do what she could do and be glad that she could do it. And I think an awareness that somehow God had used even the
the satanic pain, the evil pain, to bring her to that place of wide acceptance. It's sort of interesting, on her deathbed, she confessed that she wished she had been more merciful to conservatives. So, even she had other thorns, you know, and came to wider mercy, you know, that she was just, is a gift to know her. For that sufficiency. Comments? Reactions? Go ahead, back there.
Well, one of the things to me that makes it seem like my translation uses the word entreat in verse 8.
Okay.
That, you know, it seems to me, what comes through to me is a conviction on Paul's part that this might be too big for him to bear. You know, that yes. He was really pressed all the way to the wall, and that was part of the reason why being so demanding to God was, you know, as this gentleman said, you know, very honest. And he said, I don't think I can get through this, was what you hear coming through.
Yeah. And you see, two things rattling around in that. One step of it is it's too big for him to bear, and the second step of it is his admission that it's too big for him.
Yeah.
Now you had a comment.
I was wondering how the people at that time saw Satan, and wondering if they thought like there was some kind of battle between God and Satan, and that, you know, if Satan got a hold of you, that God couldn't, you know, overpower that, or if that had something to do with maybe why he said that, you know, even Satan, you know, that's not going to tear down God's grace, or God is still in control, or whatever.
You see, I don't know how they saw Satan. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't presume that. But I see Satan as any power moving us away from God. Any power. And the marvelous thing about this chapter is the way both strength and weakness threaten to be that power. See, we so quickly assume that pain or suffering would be that power. But self-sufficiency, ego, pride, arrogance, I can do this, very often is that power. I have no need of God. But that's not to diminish the way pain is also that power. Or torment. I mean, more than this is pain, it strikes me that this is some external kind of reality that is tormenting one and pushing one against what we believe God would do for us. And God is still able to use that. The other thing is that in a quiet way, this is claiming God's power greater than that. He doesn't shout about it. It comes closer to laughing about it. Like instead of saying, there's a mistake, it's a mistake. You know, the inflection makes all the difference in the world. The other thing Roberta said yesterday that I thought really applied to this, and she has quotations from desert monastics that taught her this. I'll just tell you, Roberta taught me this, okay? Because I don't have those references. Is it, she used to believe that prayer was taking everything that was ugly or wrong or out of place in your life and getting rid of it, kind of casting it off. And whether you imagine that as surgery, you know, somehow cutting the tumor out, or nakedness being stripped of, you know, however you picture that, it was taking a weakness and getting rid of it. She said the ancient monastics have taught her that prayer is taking our weakness, our flaws, our wrongs, those things we detest, pulling them into ourselves and pleading for God's healing. that it is taking it in. We, these things are part of us. Reality is part of us, externally and internally. And I think I've experienced that sometimes when people in parishes I've served have been fighting, and for as angry as they have been with one another, they didn't want each other to leave. And there was real sadness if somebody decided they had to leave the church. That there is a sense in which to take in those that torment us and then pray for healing and believe that in God there is healing is, I think, a real helpful image. And I can imagine will make us grateful if it helps us discover that God's grace is sufficient even for them, for them, for this, the particularity. We want to keep the prayers in the particular. It's a very different getting, is it not, than the getting rid of, getting peace with, acceptance of, maybe even appreciation for what is real in all of us and in all of the world. Other comments? Questions? We've got a few minutes yet for.
Can I come back to you? I think you just answered what he wanted to hear is in verse 9. He wanted them to hear.
Yeah.
No matter what their distraction from God. He said, if you give it to him, or you, yes. If you take it and own it, his grace is sufficient.
Yes. That's right. I think he wanted them to hear the sufficiency of grace and the power of weakness, that it might free them to be honest about their own weakness. Nothing deflates the power of wrong or weakness like owning it and being able to speak. Vulnerability that need not be a threat. And if it can be opened, it isn't. The other thing that someone said at 7:45 that I thought was so helpful is she said how she believes we want to quote the end and skip the process. You know, I don't think we mind hearing that God's grace is sufficient, but it came after the demand. And I thought there was real wisdom in that, to read it in context and to accept. It helps me when I'm sitting with grieving people, especially at the beginning of that process. I often try to say to them, this is totally unacceptable, and you have no choice but to accept. And you can't expect to somehow get those two together smoothly or evenly. It has to come through a process. And I think it's very understandable that in the midst of that process, you lose sight of that you're living out one of Elizabeth Kübler-Ross's stages. I mean, in the midst of the stage, it's easy to lose sight of that. But I hear Paul saying, this is unacceptable. And the grace of God gave him acceptance. And here again, I hear some of the power of language. One of my concerns, I said this the other day, is that we don't take words seriously enough. And the other is that we take every word as if it's the last word. That the demand here is part of the process. And in the same way that we sometimes hear people say, I need, and then when they get it out in front of them, says, well, maybe I don't need, you know. That getting it out helps you kind of see it. I think demand can function the same way. That even for those times that I have planned to say to a thorn, by the time I'm face to face with them, I'm often unable to say that. You know, better to say it in my prayers. I mean, Sue says my first book should be Sermons I Never Preached.
They're the ones she hears when I come home and is, I'm going to tell them. And I really cherish a scripture that's open about that telling and even encourages that telling. And says, as Roberta would say about Martha and Jesus' relationship, that it was served by her capacity to be at least really disappointed, if not out and out upset, that Jesus didn't get there in time. You're going
to
make it.
This is just a striking parallel to yesterday's text in terms of Jesus' own experience in the garden.
Yes.
Where he is demanding, in a sense, let this cup pass from me. I mean, nothing in our own tradition could be a more urgent and rightful demand than that. And he had to, and that was real.
Yes,
as
it was.
As was the next stage where he accepted the sufficiency of God's will.
Mm-hmm. And saying it was a part of working it out. And So the power of all of these verbs we collect is that it won't let us so easily look for shortcuts. And that you can't describe, if you're trying to describe to a friend the sufficiency of grace, you can't describe it apart from the struggle that taught you that sufficiency. The particular experiences, like you can't describe forgiveness without the sin. It means nothing apart from recognizing that you and the world in which you live are broken, and that you came to see that brokenness and to have the power to admit it, but to just say forgiveness without saying somehow that. I've admitted to you that I can have this ornery streak, and sometimes when people have said to me, oh, I wish I could play the piano like you, my orneriness has said, no, you don't. You wouldn't have wanted to go through what I went through. My mother beat the rhythm with a yardstick and not always on the piano. And, you know, practice is hard work. There is, and maybe praying is too. Or seeing is. The verb seeing here isn't here, but because Paul saw, the rest of us are able to see. You know, so we get to see what Paul went through and what he discovered in the grace of God. Are we through? Once again, I thank you for a really fine discussion. Tomorrow, we will wrap up our week as the prayer Jesus taught us is ended with doxology, the praise of God, as we hear it in the lips of Simeon and Anna in Luke 2. So, Luke chapter 2 tomorrow. Go in peace, beseech the Lord.